Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America had its robber barons, its gilded age, its malefactors of great wealth, as Teddy Roosevelt had it. Maybe we're there again. But in Russia, there's been no doubt. For the last 20 years, Russia's oligarchs have made big names and bigger fortunes. Billions piled up on guts and guile, nouveau glitter, sometimes gangster swagger and gangster business methods, all at the intersection of political power and plunder. They've provoked anger, envy, but they are part of the Russian power elite and part of London, part of New York. A big part of the banks in Cyprus, it turns out, maybe a fixture of the global economy. This hour on Point, Russia's oligarchs at home and abroad now. You can join the conversation. Do you pay attention to the fortunes and misfortunes of the oligarchs, to the Berezovsky death in London, to the Cyprus bank accounts? Are you craning your neck at basketball games in Brooklyn to see team owner Mr. Prokhorov? Are you executing trades for Roman Abramovich, walking dogs for Tony Muscovites in your town? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Moscow is Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent there for the New York Times. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure.
Hey, over the weekend, you told the story of one oligarch, I guess, who's done business with Donald Trump and Sandy Weill and more, and who found himself right in the middle of the Cyprus mess. Introduce us, if you would, Andrew.
Sure. This was a story of one wealthy Russian businessman from the Ural Mountains region of Russia. His name is Mr. Rybolovlev, and he got his start really hustling and dealing in cars, trading cars for securities in a factory, according to at least one interview he gave. So very a modest beginning in the 1990s. By the time he sold his fertilizer company in the middle of the last decade, it was worth billions of dollars. And part of that went offshore from Russia to Cyprus and from there into U.S. real estate with the Donald Trump deal that you had mentioned, where he bought a mansion from Donald Trump on Palm Beach. When he bought that, it was the most expensive private residence ever sold in the United States.
$95 million.
That's right. And, yeah. And then that was followed up by the purchase of what was at the time the most expensive apartment ever sold in New York, 15 Central Park West. So
$88 million for that apartment, you remind us.
Right. There's no shortage of free money, apparently, after the sale of that that fertilizer mine. And also a willingness to live large, which is characteristic of the oligarchs.
Andrew Kramer, back up with us here for a second. I mean, you remind us, at this point, you've got him as one of the wealthiest men in the world, these gigantic purchases in the U.S., but not only in the U.S., penthouse in Monaco, a yacht named My Anna, I guess named after one of his daughters, worth more than $100 million. But take us back to that beginning, because it tells the story of at least the first generation of oligarchs. How did he make that first money? What did it have to do with the coming apart of the Soviet Union, the Soviet system?
Well, he is archetypical in many ways of the oligarchs, a bright young man who studied medicine in a provincial city. And then realized that there was no future, or certainly no wealth in medicine in Russia, and studied securities trading in Moscow when this was a brave new world. Nobody understood stocks or equity in companies. He took this understanding back to his home region and started buying shares in a potash fertilizer company. These are large, gritty, polluting enterprises in deep in Russia. They're harmful for the environment in a number of ways by producing lots of waste salt, not so much air pollution. In any case, this beginning was what made him a wealthy man in the 1990s, and then during the commodity boom over the last decade, that wealth really grew through a whole nother burst and onto a whole other level. This is also typical of what's happened here in Russia with Russia's wealthy.
So when he sold this enormous potash company, it was very important to him to get his money out of Russia. It ended up in Cyprus. You remind us he owns almost 10%, or did own, has owned, of the Bank of Cyprus, some $70 billion in Russian deposits and loans to Cypriot companies, about 4% of Russia's GDP, everyone's been talking about in recent days, 42% of the value of Cypriot bank accounts in accounts with more than half a million euros, and many of those out of Russia. Why was this particular oligarch so, and many others, why were they, are they, so eager to get their money out of Russia?
Well, the reason is the court system is quite weak in Russia, and there are not strong property right protections. This is probably the fundamental reason why legitimate businesses and wealthy Russians like to have a portion of their money diversified out of Russia. Even working capital that might be reinvested in Russia is often moved offshore to Cyprus so that it can be then reinvested in Russia in what's called the round-tripping of the financial system in Cyprus. In his particular case, he sold his company through an IPO and then in two separate private placements over the course of several years. And a portion of that went to Cyprus. Now, we don't know how much remains there. A lot of these transactions involving Cyprus, it'll just be a waypoint to some other investment or to banks, perhaps in Switzerland, perhaps in another offshore location. But it's very convenient as a way to invest in Russia because of a strong court system in Cyprus, which retained its English legal system after it gained independence from England, but also because of a treaty against double taxation with Russia.
And to be fair, he's had his own issues to worry about over the years in Russia. I mean, this potash mine of his, what, in the town where he was mining these huge mines, it had gigantic sinkholes opening up some 50 stories deep. That's mind-boggling. 50 stories deep sinkholes opening under and around the town there, 1,000 miles east of Moscow. Talk about deep in Russia. Dozens of buildings destroyed. Thousands of people had to be moved. Great expense. See, he's had reasons to worry here. What's his relationship with Putin?
Well, it's always a bit of a mystery what any particular oligarch's relationship is with Putin. And it's really the main asset and the primary concern of a wealthy businessman is the relationship with the Kremlin, with influential figures in the Kremlin. In his case, as in so many others, it's not exactly clear. He was cleared by government commission of wrongdoing for that industrial accident in Berezniki. On the other hand, a close aide of Putin had criticized him for his role in the problems at the mine. He may come to Russia. In any case, he's not a resident of Russia any longer. So he's an example of an oligarch who's made an extraordinary sum of money in Russia and then moved abroad. And these are the ultra wealthy who might be investing in high-end real estate in the United States and France, buying sports teams such as the basketball team in Brooklyn that you had mentioned,
yes,
or the soccer team Chelsea in England, or in the case of Rybolovlev, the Monaco soccer team.
And here in this case, he's got his daughter, Ekaterina, living in New York in that gigantic apartment. So when we see oligarchs out and about around the world, often this is family, in this case, living in what was then an $88 million apartment.
Yeah, that's the apartment was bought as temporary student housing for his daughter.
Oh, geez.
That was the representation. Some of the detail of this particular businessman, and one of the reasons why I decided to write about him, has become public because of a divorce proceeding. Obviously, there are many other Russian businessmen. They all have their own arrangements, their own toehold in various countries. But as often as not, it's not public and difficult to ascertain exactly what they've done with their money, how much they've taken out of Russia, and how much they've kept here.
Andrew, you're there in Moscow. Do you see the oligarchs' era of power in Russia in the ascendant, or is it on the downturn now? How would you judge it?
I would say it's moving horizontally. And to explain that, the era of the oligarchs of the 1990s is clearly over. Over the weekend, the most archetypical representative of that group, Boris Berezovsky, died in London. Mm-hmm. And this was seen as a changing of the guard in the oligarchs. Of course, he's been out of Russia now for a decade, so his era really ended long ago when Putin came in. And at first, the idea was the wealthy of the post-Soviet privatizations would be allowed to retain their wealth if they were loyal politically to Putin. Later, it became more complicated. Not only were they expected to be loyal politically, they were also expected to invest their money in ways that were seen as serving Russia's national interest. You were expected to reinvest profits in Russian businesses, for example. So there was there was a golden rule, which is that an oligarch had to be loyal. Mm. I saw one investment bank here in Moscow then came out with a Ten Commandments of an oligarch's life that had lots of complicated rules, unspoken rules, in order to survive under Putin. That said, there are plenty of billionaires in Russia. I checked the Forbes list. There are now 110 billionaires in Russia, which compares to the other large emerging economies of 46 billionaires in Brazil, 55 in India, and 122 in China, which obviously has a larger population.
So they've still got a great big footprint in Moscow, Russia, Cyprus, as you remind us, and well beyond. Andrew Kramer, we're going to dive on in here, Moscow correspondent for the New York Times. We're really grateful to you for being with us today, Andrew. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russian oligarchs in the news, from Cyprus to London to, of course, Moscow, their money, their influence, their impact in Russia and beyond. Here's Bloomberg News talking with a Russian in Cyprus last Friday who was disgruntled about the prospect of losing money he had put in a Cypriot bank.
I think it's just stealing personal money. If your bank trying to steal 10% of your money, why should you not leave?
Yes, and why do they call it money laundering when it goes to Cyprus and investing when it goes to London? In London on Monday, Britain's Sky News reported from outside Boris Berezkov's mansion in Berkshire, just outside London.
The alarm was raised at 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoon by the oligarch's bodyguard. He hadn't seen his employer since 10:30 on Friday night, and he became concerned. He went to investigate, and he had to force a bathroom door. And when he did, he found the body of Boris Berezovsky and raised the alarm. Paramedics came here. Police officers were on the scene within minutes. And at that point, Thames Valley Police began their investigation.
Boris Berezovsky found dead in London, one of the richest and for long time one of the most controversial. With us right now from Washington is Matthew Rojansky. He's deputy director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be with you.
And from London, Mark Hollingsworth is here, author of Londongrad, From Russia with Cash, The Inside Story of the Oligarchs, regular contributor to The Times, Financial Times, Daily Telegraph, and more. Mark Hollingsworth, thank you for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
So at this point, the thinking on Boris Berezovsky is suicide, Mark. Is that right?
Almost definitely. The latest news from the police here in London is that he hanged himself. It's not definitive. He certainly died by hanging, and that's the latest information we have.
And what would the reason be if it's obvious, or is it obvious?
Well, it's not immediately obvious, but he was under enormous stress politically, financially, in his personal life. He'd gone through his multi-billion fortune. He had huge debts. His political power and influence had completely almost disintegrated. He had just gone through a divorce, and his current mistress was also suing him for assets. So he's under huge stress, and I think he really felt he had no way out, and that appears to be, at this stage, why he committed suicide.
Matthew Rojansky, we've got lots of people chipping in here online, Facebook and elsewhere, with comments and questions, and one of the common ones is, okay, you know, what's the difference between Russian oligarchs? Here Tom online says, why are Russian billionaires oligarchs and American billionaires are job creators? What's the difference between the super wealthy of Russia, the oligarchs as they get called, Matthew, and America's wealthy? Is there a difference?
I think there is a difference, although I think to give credit to the fair question that your listeners are asking, some of it's just timing. To be honest, you go back 100 years to the Gilded Age in America, you go back to sort of the Wild West, there were plenty of people making money in similarly unscrupulous, you might even say accidental ways, as has been done in Russia in the last couple of decades. But the other important differences, I would say, is just methodology. You know, the idea that in the United States, more broadly in the West, we have a legal framework through which, even though power may be very unequally distributed between the very wealthy and sort of ordinary folks, or even between the very wealthy and states, at least they sort of play by the rules. The idea in Russia from the 1990s was there are no rules, or that the oligarchs, hand in hand with the state, write the rules. And then I think the other dimension of the difference, and I'm not sure that this is entirely fair, but it simply is reality, is that to the extent that the Russian oligarchs are associated with the current authorities in Russia, those folks are not very popular. I mean, quite frankly, Putin's just not a popular guy in the West, and therefore these folks are seen as his hangers-on, his tools, and that makes them very unpopular.
Sometimes his tools, sometimes his enemies, sometimes in prison. Mark Hollingsworth, at this point, we just heard the Times reporter in Moscow say there are 110 billionaires in Russia now. So does that mean there are 110 oligarchs? Are there distinctions made? Who's an oligarch and who's not? And do we have any sense of what portion of the Russian economy they control?
Well, the word, I think we have to differentiate between the oligarchs who made their money in the 1990s and the oligarchs who have become wealthy under the Putin years. In the 1990s, oligarchs made their money largely from privatization, where they acquired assets worth billions and billions of dollars at barely 20% of the market value. And the word oligarch itself comes from the Greek term, which basically means people have made a lot of money through political influence and political intrigue and manipulation and corruption. So I think you have to be careful in terms of your terms. And whereas the oligarchs, so-called oligarchs who have become rich under Putin, are very different type of businessmen. They've made a lot of money, but largely not necessarily through political manipulation, but staying away from politics. They have been more entrepreneurial, and it's a different economy. It's more like a state capitalist economy to some extent.
What's the ratio of Yeltsin era to Putin era billionaires or oligarchs, if you will, at this point?
Well, under the Yeltsin period, there was only a very small number of people, oligarchs, barely 20, 25, who were worth billions and billions of dollars. And it was quite outrageous that basically they made all this money. And the point I would slightly disagree with Matthew is that the major difference between the robber barons, perhaps in the United States or other countries, and the Russian oligarchs is that when the Russian oligarchs made their money in very dubious circumstances, they exported their wealth out of Russia. They did not give back money to the community or to charities, and they basically moved the money out of Russia, didn't largely reinvest in Russia. They hid the money in offshore accounts like in Cyprus and offshore. They basically parked their money, hid their money, and I think that's a major difference.
Is that the same with the Putin era billionaires, oligarchs, if you will?
Well, the Putin oligarchs really is different in that their wealth is not based on privatization. It's based on more classic capitalist methods. But the Russian state will often have a shareholding or stake in their businesses, and they know that if they step out of line, then at any point the Kremlin and the state will come in and hit them with a huge tax bill. I mean, it's a very intervention. It's not a free market economy in Russia. The current oligarchs have made their money since Putin became president. Have really been they've done it in an open market economy, but having a close relationship with Putin and making sure that they don't get involved in politics. So, and at any point, the state can intervene and has intervened.
So added up, old oligarchs and new, what portion of Russia's economy do they appear? Do you have any sense, a good estimate of how much they control?
I think that the concentration of wealth is just quite staggering. I mean, I haven't seen the latest figures, but I think you'll find that 80% of Russia's wealth is controlled barely by 1% or 2%. I haven't got the exact figures, but it is quite unbelievable. And the Russian people are the people who are suffering and have done for many years. Although you could argue that, you know, that's a worldwide phenomenon, that the super rich have become even more rich over the last few years, and it's not just about the 1%, it's now about the 0.1% who control vast amounts of the global wealth.
Matthew Rojensky, how about it? This isn't just a Russian thing. This is a global phenom, and you've got concentration of wealth. Certainly, it's higher in this country than it's been in a long time, though. 80% controlled by 1 or 2%. I'm not sure how that would compare to the U.S. profile, Matthew.
Right. I mean, I think it's certainly more extreme in Russia for historical reasons and for reasons that have to do with the current government than it is in the United States, certainly, or in a lot of other countries. But it varies widely from sector to sector. I think, you know, perhaps 80% is accurate across the entire economy. I think that's probably a bit high. You know, the statistics I've heard say that the state controls nearly 50% of the economy in Russia, which makes a lot of sense given the direction of nationalization that Putin has gone since 2000. But you have to remember, and I agree with Mark on this, that the oligarchs who either made their fortunes in the 90s and then successfully transitioned into the Putin era in the 2000s, or who rose in the 2000s thanks to Putin's patronage, they're very tough to distinguish, frankly, from government. And that's simply because if the Kremlin says, you know, you shall make a loan here, well, then they make a loan there. You shall sell off your stake and this shall be the price. They do it because they recognize that those are the basic terms of the bargain. That's how they get to keep their wealth and power. The premise, too, I would just refine a couple of points that Mark made. The premise that Russian oligarchs are fundamentally different because of capital flight, right, because they're squirreling their money away in Switzerland, Cayman Islands, certainly Cyprus, you know, yes, they do that, and they do that to a very large degree. But remember, the sums we're talking about today are just so mind-bogglingly huge compared to previous eras, and information technology allows capital to move so much more freely than it did in the past. You know, remember, Switzerland wouldn't exist as it does, its banking system, you know, these various islands, Cyprus, if there wasn't broader interest and there hadn't been for decades, if not hundreds of years. And I would just point out that the story of Russian oligarchs is not over. The notion that in the United States we walk happily in and out of buildings that bear names like Rockefeller and indeed my own employer, the Carnegie Endowment, and don't even think twice about the fact that these people have shaped our public institutions, you know, there's nothing that says in 20 years or 30 years that won't be totally normal in Russia without the layers of resentment that you see today.
I mean, their equivalents of Rockefellers with foundations set up some decades down the road.
Precisely. I mean, many of these folks, if you look at the history of the Gilded Age and of Carnegie himself, of Rockefeller, of Leland Stanford, I'm a product of his university that he created on a farm.
Pretty
in the
remarkable.
Of nowhere.
Yes.
These people did this towards the end of their lives when they were comfortable in their fortunes. So give it time.
Maybe so. But, Mark, I mean, you have to wonder, given the kind of glittering displays we see in London and elsewhere, it doesn't look very philanthropic yet, at least to my sort of distant eye.
No, I think that's wishful thinking, quite frankly. Maybe at the very end of their lives, when they're looking at their legacy, they may suddenly start being philanthropic and funding foundations and giving money to good causes and charities. But at the moment, the track record shows that they will only do that to launder their reputation, to enhance the image, and it's a way of protection. So Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who owned Yukos Oil and is currently in jail because he went up against Putin. I mean, towards the end of his commercial career, before he was arrested, he suddenly started setting up foundations in the United States and the UK and funding institutions for public policy purposes. But that was mainly to improve his reputation for corporate governance purposes when he needed foreign investors he was looking for American foreign investors to invest in Yukos Oil. So he suddenly became much more open less opaque and would suddenly have his companies run in a more Western way. So I'm very skeptical that there's no track record at all, but there are exceptions of Russian oligarchs funding charitable or public policy in foundations.
A little late for Khodorkovsky. We've seen the pictures of him, of course, in the cage at trial. Let me go to Charlie in New Haven, Connecticut. Charlie, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to talk about, well, in particular, Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, who owns the Chelsea Football Club in London. I think he's a good example of very public spending of money in ways that are often seem to be splashes of cash for the sake of toys and fun. I mean, we've got Russian people owning the biggest yacht in the world, the biggest apartment here and there, but I wonder why is this seen so different from, say, oil wealth in the Middle East being spent in similar ways throughout the world? I'll take my answer off there.
It's a good question, Mark. Is it? Let me take the London profile. Does the Russian money look different from Middle Eastern? I'll come first to you with that, or American?
Well, I think it does, in the sense of there's a certain air of a menace with Russian oligarchs. It's not just that they use very opaque and unaccountable financial mechanisms to move the money. It's all offshore. It's their financial wealth is structured in a deliberately opaque and complicated way that nobody can trace the origins of the money. They're not accountable to anyone. They don't have wealth in their own name. And so I think, and you know, in recent years we've seen evidence of business associates being murdered. You know, we've had, and even in London, we've had cases of Russian businessmen being
plenty
victims of contract killing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, these people really don't have any moral compass at all. And they don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in accountability. So I think, you know, that's really the problem. It's not so much that they're very wealthy. The world is full of wealthy people. I think that the issue is really that they really don't believe in playing by any kind of rules of corporate governance, of paying tax, being accountable, having any part of the community from which has made them wealthy.
But then there's the global community. So, Matthew, does it matter? I mean, we have this feeling we're in a new Wild West globally sometimes. The global economy allows huge concentrations of wealth. And, of course, you can treat that. You can come at the society that's your home base in different ways with that wealth. Do you see these as really different from, you know, take your pick, Brazilian, Middle Eastern, American, in terms of their commitment to law, to their home country, to something like order globally?
Yeah, Tom, I think we have to be really, really careful here about mm-hmm. stereotyping and kind of the position of privilege of the already arrived versus the still arriving, and whether or not, you know, $10 billion declares one to have been arrived, they are still relative newcomers to the global elite. I think, you know, the perception among many Russians, be they the wealthy, powerful oligarchs or ordinary folks, is that we apply a double standard in the West. And I feel, frankly, strange to find myself in the position of sort of defending these folks morally, which I certainly wouldn't do. But remember, there was a reason we called it the Gilded Age in the United States. There was plenty of flashy consumption. Just look
sure.
around in our major cities. And it's not all flashy, by the way. I mean, we talk about the extreme cases. We talk about the playboy billionaires, the Prokhorovs, the Abramoviches, the ones who love fighting each other in order to show how tough they are, buying the biggest and the best and the most expensive. But there are literally hundreds, and Russians know this, who are very quiet about their wealth, who want to hold on to it, who are not looking to provoke international or domestic reaction. And you honestly, you have to explain some of this lavish spending simply with the cultural circumstances of Russia. This is not a place where you are rewarded for saving money. And in fact, the Cyprus situation is underscoring that point to this moment, which is you put your money away, it might get taken from you. Better to spend it now and enjoy it now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Russian oligarchs in the news, from Cyprus to London to, of course, Moscow, their money, their influence, their impact in Russia and beyond. Matthew Rojansky is with us from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, joins us from Washington, Deputy Director of the Russia and Eurasia Program there. Mark Hollingsworth is with us from London, where a very prominent oligarch has just in the last couple of days hanged himself, it appears. He's author of Londongrad, From Russia with Cash, The Inside Story of the Oligarchs. Janine's calling from Cosgrove, Iowa. Hi, Janine, you're on the air.
Thank you. I would like for everyone to remember the devastation that the oligarchs caused to the huge masses of poor people in Russia. if when you go through the metro and you see old people begging, or you see girls out on the street selling flowers, maybe earning 50 cents a day, teachers 10 years ago were making $25 a month. They're probably making 40 or 50 now. And anyone after, when privatization started, anyone in management was free to steal everything they could. And the higher up they were in management, the more they can steal, and they did. Those are the oligarchs. But it was also true for everyone in middle management or low management.
Janine, did you witness this? Did you see it?
I didn't see it. I got there after it happened. But I was in a village just north of Mongolia, South Siberia. And I was trying to help the school there. And I was hearing from the people how good they had it under communism. Everyone had some kind of a job. Everyone had enough food. Everyone had some kind of education and some medical care. And now unemployment is extremely high. Medical care is almost non-existent because no one can afford the medications. People out in the country, in the villages, have really suffered from what the oligarchs did, because the oligarchs stole everything that could be stolen.
Janine, let us pick it up right there. You put a lot on the table for us. Matthew Rojansky, you see Janine's, you hear Janine's perspective there. What about Russian public opinion at this point about the those with concentrated wealth in their country? How are they seen?
You know, Janine is absolutely right about the suffering of ordinary Russians. That is especially true outside of major cities. Indeed, some have, I think, rightly described Russia as two countries. You know, the major cities, Moscow, St. Petersburg, and then the rest of the country. However, it's also said that history in Russia can be very unpredictable. And this is fundamentally a debate about history, about what happened and who is responsible. And this is where Vladimir Putin has a very distinct perspective that's carrying the day, I think, to a large degree within Russia. He basically argues that this was not about what Russians did to one another, but this was about what the West, in its moment of callous triumph and great hubris after the end of communism, imposed on Russia. His argument, and there is a lot of evidence for this, is that, you know, the United States and other Western powers came in with a vision of sort of how to transform Russia overnight into a capitalist free market democracy, and that the costs of that vision, whether it was intended as such or it was simply carelessness, was the kind of suffering that Russians are experiencing to this day. One of the purposes that this serves for Putin, and this is where I think is very relevant to what's going on now in Cyprus, is to discredit the Western model more generally, is the argument that, you know, what the West has built has been built on the basis of injustice, on the basis of indifference towards the lowest in society, and that if you look at Cyprus today, you see tremendous hypocrisy. Why is Cyprus different? Why should we punish Cyprus? You know, these banks are totally unreliable. Ordinary people in Cyprus who depend on Russian money for their jobs, they're going to lose their jobs, and it's completely unfair.
But you talk about indifference and injustice, and that seems rife in Russia, as Janine and many others describe it. And what's Putin offering as an alternative here? And isn't he also tied up with plenty of oligarchs himself?
There's no question, right? Putin is a master of distraction. It is a red herring to point to problems in the West. That's frankly even an old Soviet tactic to say, for example, sure, you've got, you know, discrimination against minorities in the United States, so you're just as bad as we are. That said, Putin does have an awful lot to offer that works for his constituency, okay? You've got to carefully define this. Folks who work for basically state-controlled industries or industries that are oligarch-controlled but with close ties to the state, they get relatively steady, reliable paychecks. It's true that a lot of them don't have the kind of predictable, regular privileges that they would have had in communist times, but you know what? They weren't doing that well then either, and relative to the chaos of the 90s, they're doing better today. So his argument is persuasive, and as I say, it's carrying the day for now in Russia.
Mark, what about this Putin notion that the Western model, not only did it exploit Russia, but it's kind of failed or failing, and his you know, hand in glove with the big boys works better, and let's have a new way here.
That's a correct analysis of the 90s from Matthew, but that is absolutely true. The origins of the rip-offs and the privatizations of the 90s, which resulted in the oligarchs, was based on advice from American economists who did advocate that, and that was taken on as their economic model. But the problem now is that when Putin came to power, a lot of his policies were based on, you know, that he was going to reinvest wealth and resources in Russia, and he's not done that. And I think where I would slightly disagree with Matthew is that the big problem is that with the high oil price and the amazing natural resources that Putin has at his disposal, he has not invested in the infrastructure of Russia. In Russia, you've still got horrendous problems in the infrastructure with the lack of investment in the roads and just basic facilities. Anyone who goes to Moscow can see that. And you've still got a lot of corruption. And I think that the difference is that, you know, Putin has adopted a kind of state capitalist model where the state has strategic stakes in most of the industries. You know, the oil industry is virtually a nationalized company. It's a state-owned corporation. And so, I mean, he's taken on an interventionist role. But where he's failed is that he has not invested that wealth in the country, and he's just sort of managed the wealth, and he's not really improved the conditions for ordinary Russians. I mean, it's certainly better than the 90s. But he's certainly failed in terms of investing that wealth for the benefit of the Russian people.
Let me get a call from Chicago here. Michael's calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing? Yeah, I wanted to talk to you. You know, it's not right for us to tell somebody how to spend their money. Well, no matter how they made it, if I make money, you can't tell me that I can't burn it or give it away or whatever. We're being socialist by telling the oligarchs or anybody else that has any money what to do with their money. Or how they should spend it, whether they give it to the poor or they reinvest it in their country, that's up to them.
And if it was more or less stolen in the first place, does that matter to you, Michael, or not?
Then the government should go after them. Then they should have, you know, somebody go after them for doing illegal activity. But until that happens, and they prove that there was illegal activity, then, you know, who are we to tell? We're being socialists saying you should do this and you should do that.
Okay, Michael, we got it. Matthew, some kind of measured critique of the Russian oligarchs' socialist position?
This is exactly the point, to be honest, is that Putin does not, when he does deals with oligarchs, he does not embrace the culture of oligarchy for the public. This is not his political position. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say, you know, they are good and they are right and vast wealth is good. He plays both sides. He does deals with them, but he throws them under the bus when he needs to, making precisely the type of socialist arguments that have populist appeal. He says, you know, Berezovsky, the guy who put him in the position of the presidency, by the way, who plucked him from sort of obscurity and made him Yeltsin's right-hand man, he throws him under the bus. Then he throws Khodorkovsky under the bus. More recently, he throws Alexander Lebedev under the bus. The idea is that Putin is a very skilled politician, and that's how he keeps his system stable. He never accuses these guys of being, you know, sort of too important, too powerful, too talented. He says they violated the law, and I have evidence, fabricated or otherwise, and here it is. And he puts them on trial. It's exactly what he's done with Khodorkovsky. So he's making exactly the skilled arguments that appeal, frankly, to people who are open to the socialist claims, but also people who are more of Michael's mentality in Russia.
So do the oligarchs ever en masse stay in Russia if they're always at risk of being thrown under the bus? How does that roll out, Matthew?
This is what Putin ultimately wants, and this is why Cyprus is so very good for Mr. Putin and the Kremlin. He wants the wealth repatriated. He knows that one of the side effects of the deal that he has done over the past decade with powerful Russians is that money has flowed abroad in truly titanic amounts. But if he can begin the process of reversing that, and it will be very difficult and it may ultimately be impossible, by showing that, look, your deposits abroad, be they in Cyprus, be they in the City of London, be they in the United States, which has just passed sanctioning legislation against many powerful and wealthy Russians over alleged human rights abuses, you need to bring that money back to Russia. At the very least, in Russia, a deal is a deal with me. Now, we know that's not true, and the oligarchs realize it too, but if they're taking their chances everywhere in the world, they might as well keep their money at home in Russia, and that benefits Putin and the Kremlin and this system that he's created around him, the vertical of power.
Let's go to Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. So, to me, the oligarchs of new are like the czars of old. I mean, when I was in St. Petersburg, I walked up to visit a friend, 10 floors in a building that had no heat or power. And I think once the old and the sick and end up dying off, things will change just like they did before. And perhaps they may change worldwide. You can't keep your booted foot on the neck of people for too long before something collectively happens. And I'll just go.
Okay. Dave, thanks for calling. Mark, there's the intimations that, you know, the Russians will rise up against the oligarchs at some point and those who do business with them. How about it?
Well, it's unlikely because they don't have any real political power. There's no democracy in Russia, and so there's no vehicle for the ordinary Russian to bring down oligarchs, so they will support any politician who moves against the oligarchs, which is why Putin was elected effectively and was certainly supported when he first became president. But the real difference in Russia, the real problem is the lack of the rule of law. So that, you know, one of your previous callers said, well, we were being socialist in saying that you should move against rich people who have made a lot of money you're being socialist in trying to move against people who have made a lot of money. Well, actually, the problem is that, as you had indicated, They made their money effectively by ripping off the Russian state and a lot of illegal activity. But also, there is actually no vehicle for bringing them to account in terms of making them pay tax and bringing them, because there's no rule of law in Russia. It's heavily politicized. It's corrupt. It's arbitrary, and so you have no form of accountability or vehicle for bringing them to account for their misdeeds.
You know, Matthew, our caller in Des Moines is asking about upheaval here. Mark is right. Maybe there's no legal recourse, but there was no legal recourse under the Tsar either, I guess, and they found a way, and it was pretty revolutionary, literally revolutionary. Do you see an upheaval evolving out of this, or do you see some kind of just steady state? I mean, is Vladimir Putin said, well, this is my model and it works better than the West. It's authoritarian, yes, but come on, we've got a kind of a new Eurasian way here. Let's go down this road. Or do you see revolt down the road?
Well, I think there are two kind of stereotypes about Russia that are always exaggerated. The first is the power of the Tsar, the sort of impermeable, inviolable power of the Kremlin. I mean, it's not perfect. Putin's very skilled, but there are many fissures in his regime. But the other exaggeration is the idea that the Russian people are sort of indifferent, ambivalent. They're just kind of sheep who can be herded around throughout Russian history. If you look at Russian history, the Bolshevik Revolution is one of many instances where the Russian people have risen up. But ask why. Why do they rise up? They don't rise up because they're mad that there isn't enough democracy, or they're mad that the laws are not good enough. Russian people rise up when they don't have bread. Russian people rise up when they are threatened by disease and famine and foreign attacks. And they will do those things again in the future. But for now, I think the system benefits very much from the stability that comes of high natural resource prices and exports. The oligarchs are absolutely a secondary outgrowth of that system. It's something that Russians have a great distaste for, but they're prepared to tolerate as long as they can get by. And for the moment, the fact is enough Russians are getting by through their own self-sufficiency and through support from the state that Putin is looking at a relatively stable system in the short term.
Is he in a position of enough stability that he's saying to Cyprus, this sort of Eurasian Union idea of his, we've got a better way than the West? Yes, it's hand in glove, sort of, you know, rich and authoritarian a bit, but it's a better way. Let's do it. Maybe China likes it too. Let's go.
That is exactly what Putin is saying. He's saying it explicitly. He's saying it implicitly. He's working all kinds of multilateral and bilateral deals to make that happen. It is not a new Soviet Union. It's not about ideology. He's not a communist. His goal is to build a global power center in which Russia is a critical decider, a critical unifier of those who are on the periphery of what you would call the other global power center, the United States, Europe, and the Transatlantic Alliance. And he can attract folks who are on Europe's periphery, like Cyprus. Cyprus. If Cyprus gets kicked out of Europe, out of institutional Europe, do you think that they're going to turn back to Berlin, who has wronged them and called their banks criminal, or will they turn to their fellow Orthodox country, you know, whose deposits are the size of their GDP, which has always been close, Russia? I mean, that's exactly what Russia is looking for, and they're certainly pushing very hard with Ukraine, with Belarus, Kazakhstan, and the former Soviet space. It makes good sense if you're Putin, because you can't join the West. That's become very clear to him after a decade. So why not beat them?
So which way does the world tilt in his neck of the woods? Russian oligarch or West? Or which way do you see the big, huge picture going, Mark? Matthew?
I think ultimately it's going to be a little bit of both. Putin is himself a little bit of an oligarch, a little bit of a patriot, a little bit of a true believer, a little bit of a revolutionary.
Wow. And meanwhile, Mark, the limo still cruise through the streets of your town, London.
Yeah, no, it's London has become Little Moscow, and you know, we see oligarchs' money all over the city, and you know, it's something to be concerned about. But the institutions here are really not prepared to do anything about them, either scared of them or just not prepared to take any action.
Well, eyes wide open as Cyprus looks for its way forward. Mark Hollingsworth, author of London Grad, joining us from London. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
And Matthew Rojanski at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.